Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mealer here. Great to have you with us today as we visit with Melinda Myers, nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, author, columnist, over 30 years of horticulture experience, and she has written over 20 gardening books. And she has lots of advice and information on her website. I hope you'll take a look at that, melindamyers.com. We'll talk with her about the importance of green spaces in our lives and in our communities to start the program. And, of course, we'll take your questions about those topics and other gardening ones as well. And I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Melinda Myers, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Always great to chat with you and your listeners, Larry, and talk gardening, of course.
Yeah, well, let's talk about green spaces here a little bit. They're important for a lot of reasons, I guess. How do you define a green space?
You know, that's a really good question. I think a lot of times we think of large landscapes or we think of parks, but there's been a lot of research that finds that there's a lot of metro nature. Tree-lined streets, for example, of course, tot lots and parks, a nice yard, whether it's tiny. I had a small city lot in Milwaukee for 26 years and packed it full of plants, and it brought me and I think my neighbors a lot of pleasure, just a break from all of the blacktop and hard surfaces and the noise in the neighborhood that really helps screen that out. So I think anything we can do, if you're in an apartment, you know, we see those balconies filled with planters and containers and people creating these beautiful gardens in that whatever space is available. And so I think all of us realize that whether you garden indoors, you know, where a lot of us are looking indoors right now because of the weather, you know, green plants inside, holiday plants, or if you garden outside, as gardeners, we know the health benefits. We go out and dig weeds or plant flowers, and we feel the reduction in stress and our mood elevated. But research is putting some dollars and cents to that feelings that we had and really aligning it with some health benefits and some financial and economic benefits for individuals and communities as well.
And you have access to some of that research, and I believe our listeners will as well.
You bet. So the U.S. Forest Service did some research and found that the United States could save up to $6.8 billion a year by reducing the cost of money spent on prescriptions and treating ADHD and Alzheimer's disease, $3.4 billion by increasing graduation rates. You know, kids, they found, are more focused. They exhibit less ADHD symptoms, and we're more creative. I think you saw some of the research out of Japan. Many of your listeners probably did, where they looked at employees and put a plant on their desk and asked them to tend that plant, and they found the employees were more focused. They were more creative. And so I think that's really exciting when you put a dollar and cent value onto something we as gardeners know is real. And then I think as gardeners, we have the opportunity to improve the green space, whether it's planting native plants, planting trees to help manage stormwater, putting in rain barrels to capture water and keep it on our landscape, creating rain gardens. And the websites to some of this information are on your website, the links to those information, including Fresh Coast Guardians. They have a lot on what we can do, green strategies to improve our environment and work with nature to create beautiful landscapes that support water quality, pollinators, and just creating those spaces that improve our mood, reduce road rage, and do all those good things.
And we have that research up at go to WPR.org/Larry and go to today's date and the program notes. Mackenzie Crummy has those entered in, I believe, already, so you can get a look at that research. I was thinking about my own place. You know, I there's no grass in the front. I've got a little lawn in the front, but I have a little space in the front, but I've got the space between the sidewalk and the street. I've done a lot there, and there's lots of nice flowers, and there's kind of lawn or grass on both. The neighbors have grass on both sides, but I always think mine's kind of a nice little surprise when you get down that part of the block. And then I didn't want to mow anyway, so I have a nice flower garden in the front right by my front porch. And I think it just makes things more inviting.
You bet. And I bet, Larry, your neighbors have followed your lead to some extent. When I lived in the city, everybody had short mown grass, rows of geraniums and sheared yews, and we gradually killed our lawn, did exactly what you did, put in small shrubs, flowers, and, you know, I remember the day we were sitting on our front porch and went, let's just finish it off and plant it all. And it first, our neighbors were like, what are these people doing? And then all of a sudden, we started seeing other people expanding their planting beds. And when I was leaving, I'd moved out of the city, but several of my neighbors installed rain gardens. And so it was exciting to see that we were all inspiring each other. And I'm sure you've done that with your garden, or if nothing else, one of my favorite moments, I was out weeding, and this young kid rides by on his bike, and he goes, nice garden, lady. So you impress a kid with a garden, a teenager, I figure we're doing some good.
Oh, man, I would agree with that. Well, are cities acting on this research?
I think many are. I've been involved with the Wisconsin Arborist Association and the International Society of Arboriculture, and I know many cities across the country, this is giving them some ammunition to go to and say, we need to maintain our city budgets that are keeping trees intact. We've got some excellent urban foresters here in Wisconsin that I know have been working with their tree boards and commissioners and the powers to be to maintain budgets and hopefully increase tree planting, parks and green spaces as well. And so I think as citizens, one of the things we can do is let our representatives know that we think this is important as they're looking at budgets, and then sharing that information as well. So, you know, we all have a choice of where our dollars get spent, and there's always more projects, you know, than we have money available and time to do. But I think if we can look at some of these things and think about where we can get some positive impact, you know, hopefully, you know, it does so many good things financially, emotionally, mentally, that I think this is a way we can support those that are trying to get those urban forest and green spaces increased and maintained in our areas.
I think these Tree City USA programs are great to and have really done wonders in some cities here in Wisconsin.
Oh, you bet. I was lucky enough years ago to speak at the awards presentation, and it was just so exciting to see so many municipalities recognized for their work at maintaining that. And now there's a Bird City Bird City program. And those things go hand in hand, right? If bird population is healthy, that's a good indication things are going to be good for us as well.
Absolutely. Melinda Meyer is our guest today. We're starting here talking about the benefits of green spaces. And, of course, we can take other gardening questions as well, indoors or outdoors, for that matter. And I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. You know, when you were talking, Melinda, about what we can do as individuals, and you talked about some of the groups, I immediately thought about the Wisconsin Master Gardeners Association. Oh. I had the great opportunity to speak at their annual meeting this past week, and there's so many vibrant, busy, healthy, active gardeners there. It was a joy to talk with them, and they could swing a little effort out there too.
You know, that's a really good point. And I was lucky enough to start the program in Milwaukee County, and so it's near and dear to my heart for many reasons. Like you said, just such a great group of people, good energy, you know, making a difference for gardeners and soon-to-be gardeners of all ages. And I know a lot of them are also looking to help support their community. So this is the kind of research that I need to help make sure they get in their hands too, so they can help us as well, because they're already doing a lot of work and budgets are tight. And I always say my time at Extension, you can probably relate, taught me how to be very fiscally conservative and ask for help, whether it's time, money, or something else.
Oh, man. Melynn Myers, our guest. It's always great to talk with her. And you have some in-person events coming up soon, including Garden Expo. I'll be there as well. But talk about what you've got.
Well, I'm so excited to be back in person, just like you, Larry.
Yeah.
And once again, I'll be having a booth, so I'll be available throughout every day, but I'm also presenting four times during the program, during the event. And it's such a wonderful time. I think we all missed it. The virtual option was great last year. It helped kept us going, but I know we all benefit from the chats that happen, to the people managing the booths, the speakers. In the aisleway when you're shopping, the benefit for me of working in a booth is I don't have as much time to spend money, but I always find a way to leave a little cash behind and see what's new and available. And I'll be doing some traveling, so always check my website. My webinars, I'll continue to do those. We've had such great luck, and it gives me an opportunity to stay connected. So if a snowstorm's in the forecast, you don't have to get in your car and drive. You can just tune into the webinar. And my 2021 webinars are up and free to listen to, along with the handouts free to download through the end of this year. So, you know, if you need a little break from the holiday stress or have a moment or two you want to think gardening and it's not good to garden outside or you've got everything taken care of inside, you know, join me for one of the recorded webinars.
And that's at MelinnaMyers.com. And just so people know, your last name is spelled M-Y-E-R-S, MelinnaMyers.com. Well, we have callers online, and we'll get to them. Let's get to them right now, or at least to Tim. Tim in New Berlin will give you a chance. Thanks for calling.
Sure, thank you. Yes, I agree with your guest, Melinda. And what I think that, we need to understand is that green space is good for the economy. I live in New Berlin, and a lot of pavement is going on right now, and the local leadership likes to say, oh, well, it's good for the economy. No, it's not. It's a flash in the pan. It's an illusion, because if you reduce your livability, if you destroy the green space and people don't want to live here because it's just like every other congested area, then it's bad for the economy. Now, people who go to Europe, you go to Germany, for instance, where I used to be stationed in the military, they have clear ordinances and land use policies. When you come to the edge of the city, development does not continue. You recycle the land.
Yeah.
And, you know, Tim, you've got a great point in that information from the U.S. Forest Service, and there are links in that as well. And then Project Evergreen, I forgot to mention also, had research related to green space where they put dollars and cents, exactly what you're saying. And I think it sounds like you are trying to help get the word out. And I think arming ourselves with some of that financial economic benefit, as you mentioned, is a way to help people understand that it's not just, okay, well, that looks nice and so it's pretty, but let's, you know, put in buildings that are taxable and things like that. And I understand. I worked for the city of Milwaukee for a while, and, you know, and so I get we've got to look at our budgets, but you bring up a good point, bringing that economics into it. I think that's what drove part of this research was people saying we need to look at all of the benefits. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. And Tim, you and others, anybody else, might want to go to our website, go to ideas to WPR.org/Larry, and check today's program notes, and those data are there. So you can click on them and take a look. Melinda Myers, our guest today. Tyler Ditters, our very capable engineer. Jill Nadeau, our very capable producer. And I'm Larry Mueller, and you're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. And you're also listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with our guest today, Melinda Myers. We've been talking a bit about the benefits of green spaces and communities, but taking other gardening questions as well. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Lee in Cudahy, we'll go to you now. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I enjoy your show very much.
Thank you.
But my problem is I walk the dog in a residential area, and about 19 years ago, they started putting in condominiums. Now, they insist that everybody has to have green grass. Well, there's no worms anymore. About the last 3 years, I asked people, where are the worms? I don't know. And now I notice on the grass of front lawns, including ours, it's like a desert of, it's like eating up the grass, but there's no worms.
Yeah. Well,
you know, and worms are such a controversial thing. As gardeners, yeah. We know the benefit of earthworms in our garden. One of the problems, Lee, and I agree, we can, if we diversify our landscape plantings like Larry has done in his front yard and many other people have, we bring in lots of beneficial insects that live in the soil, that build our soil, and the pollinators we support that we depend upon. Earthworms in the gardener are not a problem. They do aerate the soil, but we've seen problems in natural spaces where people have dumped their bait in woods, and then those earthworms devour the organic matter. And then jumping worms have moved into the area, unfortunately. And the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the Arboretum, has done a they're doing some research. They have a great webinar on their YouTube channel. And we're trying to find out how to manage this because this jumping worm, it's not native here, and it devours organic matter at such a high level that it really ruins the soil. And if it gets into our natural spaces, it jeopardizes our forest. So you're right, Lee. We need to look at the whole ecosystem. And I think, you know, if you look over landscaping over periods of time, the trends have changed. And, you know, lawns became, you know, kind of a trend. They are play area, so that's nice for sports. But, you know, if you had a nice front lawn and it plays off your flowers and, you know, people like to go mow their grass, not everybody but some. And so how can we manage those spaces so that they're manageable? People are happy, a little bit messy, because that's what our pollinators need. So, you know, I think it's all of us that are looking for some creating these wonderful ecosystems for pollinators, birds, and ourselves, just helping people understand how they can make a difference. And sometimes it's removing a little bit of lawn at a time. You know, it's getting those people that are on the condo landscaping committee to start challenging the company. Hey, let's expand our garden and planting beds. Let's have less lawn. You know, give me more space to garden. So I think we have many opportunities, Lee, and it's a good observation you made. I think as we all walk around our neighborhood, just kind of looking at those changes and how we can have some positive impact.
Yeah, good points. Lee, thank you very much for calling. Grant in Brookfield, what's on your mind?
Hi, Grant.
Grant, are you there? Grant had a question about horseradish. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll hope that he comes back, and we will instead go to Chris in Adams. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. You know that you're a crazy garden person when you're planting bulbs in December.
I'm with you. I'm with you, Chris. I'm waiting for that thaw. I've got a couple hundred.
Yeah, next week it's going to be 60 degrees out, so I got a bunch of bulbs here that have to go in the ground. Fortunately, my bed is already dug out. I just have to put compost on top of it. I have a question. I, like Larry, have dug up my whole front yard, and it's all perennials, and I have started working on the space in between the sidewalk and the street, and I put a hibiscus in the middle of this thing, and everything else is thriving. But the hibiscus died, and I'm wondering if it's from the street salt. And I'm asking whether or not you have a suggestion for something I can put in there that's flowering that will be tolerant of the salt in the street?
You know, great question, and that would be my guess. Is it a, you know, the perennial hibiscus? I'm assuming the perennial, not the hibiscus, not the Rose of Sharon, which is a type of hibiscus. They like moist soil. I'm guessing the salt really took its beating. The Ohio State University has a list of some flowering plants. I also look to the boulevards when I, you know, am looking for things that are salt tolerant. I did want to mention, whenever you're looking at planting the space between the sidewalk and the curb, check with your local municipality. There may be some visibility restrictions. When I was in Milwaukee, the only restriction, you know, it had to be visibility, but if they had to come in and do work, if the tree ended up dying and they had to, you know, take it down, they wouldn't replace my garden.
Yeah.
So just kind of do that, just, you know.
Yeah, that's what happens here, too.
Okay. So I don't want to be negative. Just I hate for anyone to put effort in and then the city, your municipality, say you're not allowed to do that. So a couple things. When you look to it, heat and drought tolerant plants are also a good choice. I've seen the catmints like Walker's Loaf, and they bloom all summer long. Some of the dianthus, believe it or not, are somewhat salt tolerant. When I was at the city, I did maintain a strip of grass, just a mower width to kind of give my gardens a break, because what would happen when they would plow, all the snow ended up in that garden bed. And even though, you know, people are driving by, so I thought I'd give my plants a break. When I was working for forestry, we had some areas where we actually put pavers next to the curbing, permeable pavers, so that it kind of acted as a barrier. In fact, we did that with the police stations because we kept replacing grass. And so we ended up putting pavers that would allow that salty water to go down. It didn't help with flying salt from cars passing by that you might be experiencing, Chris. A lot of your grasses tend to be very tolerant. Now, granted, they're not going to give you those flowers, but I really like Verbena bonariensis, which is the tall verbena, and it reseeds readily, and I like to mix that with my grasses, and that would be something that could reseed if you did, say, Carl Forster feathery grass. It would give you some height. These verbena tend to be pretty tall as well. Plant those together. It grows through, and you have flowers for most of the summer as well. Salvias, to some extent, I've seen do pretty well. I'd set them back a bit from the edge of the garden. And then I think anything that tends to be drought tolerant seems to also have some good salt tolerance. I grew Siberian bellflower, which was a low grower. It was a spring bloomer along my sidewalk, where all the neighbors that had salted their sidewalk, it all kind of rolled down the hill to my yard and sidewalk, and it tolerated that pretty well also. So those are just a couple things. And then just do an internet search for salt-tolerant plants at the Ohio State University. I know they did some research on that topic.
Seem to be doing okay. Might just dig down there a little bit and find a great big fat old rock right underneath your hibiscus.
Hibiscus. That's a really good point. You know, thank you, Larry, for reminding me. I can't tell you how many people would come in when I was working for Extension, and I'd send them back with a shovel, and they dig down, and sometimes they found landscape fabric because the previous owner kept mulching, right? Or they found there was a sidewalk there, good point. Always check the soil first. Excellent point, Larry.
Oh, okay. Well, Chris, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Grant in Brookfield, we'll go to you now. Hi, Grant.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi, Melinda. It's an honor to be able to talk to you guys. I have recently dug up some horseradish tubers in Indiana. This is the second year of making some kind of horseradish sauce. Last year I did it with sour cream and something else that was mayonnaise, and they turned out pretty good. This year I made it with just vinegar, and it was a little stronger. I'm wondering about when I dug up a bunch of these tubers, some of them had little shoots on them. so I put them in some dirt. I'm hoping I'll be able to transplant them back to Wisconsin. Is that a possibility?
Oh, I definitely would do that. Horseradish is really tough. I've got it growing in a grow bag that I bring in my garage in the winter and out in the summer. I'm every year think, okay, this is the year I'm harvesting and processing. But you've inspired me, Grant. Next year I'm harvesting and processing and putting some back in the ground. So if you can keep it so you've got little sprouts and it's starting to grow, I think if you can get it back in the garden so that it doesn't put on a lot of growth, that then you're putting it outside with green leaves in the middle of winter. You could try growing it indoors in a sunny window or under artificial lights till next spring, but you know, who wants to grow horseradish? Maybe inside, but I would try to get it in the garden if you can. You know, this warm spell coming up next week might be an opportunity to pop it in the ground. And, you know, it's a tough plant, so I think you have a good chance of keeping it going.
Remember, it likes to spread, too, Grant.
Thank you. Thank you, Larry. That's why mine's in a grow bag. So either surrounded by cement. When I worked for Extension, there was a deserted garden that had been, you know, let go, a research part of the research gardens that had been let go. And when I cleaned it out, I not only found rhubarb, but I found horseradish that nobody – it had just taken over this area despite the quack grass and all the other weeds. So – good point. You might want to just drive to Indiana, harvest it out of your friend's garden. Thank you for reminding me, Larry.
Oh, boy. Good luck, Grant. Thank you so much for calling. Lori and Shano, let's go to you now. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I'm a sucker for a plant, whether it's inside or outside. And this time of year, because of the dreariness, I am particularly vulnerable. And I bought 3 Norfolk Island pine a couple of years ago when they were on sale after Christmas. Now, the new growth on these pines have been normal, and the needles are the normal size. But now I've got some that are about twice as long, and the needles are really rigid. Now, I know with normal trees, if you lopped off the top, you would kill them. I kind of want to keep these small, too, but would that kill them, and why would they be doing that? Is it a hybrid or what?
You know, Norfolk Island pines, when we bring them inside, they tend to do exactly what is happening. One, these grow outside in tropical forest, and they look like a typical pyramidal evergreen. And so it's often difficult for us to give them sufficient sunlight, even in a sunny window, to keep that growth habit consistent. They like moist soil, high humidity. You're obviously doing all of that right, other than living in Wisconsin trying to grow it inside. So if you can do anything to boost the light, if you prune out the growing tip of trees, what happens, or most of any plant really, you remove a growth hormone called auxin, A-U-X-I-N, and that will encourage more compact growth and branching. So when that Norfolk Island pine is setting out that new shoot, if you pinch it off, what is likely to happen is you'll get 2 new shoots coming out of that top. Then you could train one of those to do that. When you're looking at the side shoots, you know, if you cut back those long shoots, you're right. That's kind of the end of the branch. They're terminal growers from those side shoots. Now, so you're going to have to decide if you can just find a way to, you know, make it look good given that situation. One of the other options might be to do air layering. Is they're getting too big for the house? And air layering is basically you take the stem below the part where you want to start a new plant, so maybe where those branches are huge, cut halfway into the stem, prop it open with a toothpick, and then put some rooting hormone in there, wrap it in moist sphagnum moss, and surround that area with plastic and tie it off top and bottom. It takes a couple months, and then you'll eventually see some roots coming through. Then you can cut below that point, remove the plastic, and plant it so you have a rooted cutting. The benefit there would be all those long branches would be at the bottom, and hopefully if you get some artificial light onto that plant, increase the light, that you can manage that growth habit a little better. Otherwise, it's a real typical thing that we see with Norfolk Island pines growing inside.
Yeah, there you go, Lori. Thank you very much for calling. Good luck. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Daniel, who's near Toma. Hi, Daniel.
I'm on 94, shy of Toma, but heading towards Madison. I, when you were talking about the boulevard, I reminded of this anecdote of my own. I drove cab in Minneapolis for many years, and there was this gorgeous, there was a corner house with this gorgeous boulder in the front yard, about 3 feet high with this red, 3-inch wide red striation in one direction and a couple of 1-inch striations in a different direction. I'm still scratching my head how those intersected. Then one day I got a call to that address and picked up a woman, and she was a homeowner, and I said, I love your boulder. And she said, the city workers dug that up out of the middle of the intersection.
Whoa.
And she went out and said, what are you going to do with that? And they said, oh, we got to haul it away. And she said, you can haul it right over here in my yard. And then she went and bought them a case of beer or six-pack of beer or something like that. And she's got a couple of little plants. She got a couple of little plants around it, short, you know, foot tall. Just a gorgeous, gorgeous boulder. I mean, you'd have to pay a lot of money to throw something like that.
Oh, that's a good story, Daniel.
That is a great story. It was a win-win. The city didn't have to move it as far, and she got a beautiful element for her landscape, too. That's great. When I left my house in Milwaukee, the new owners didn't want gardens. And so, you know, I took my plants with me, and I had some really nice boulders. And convincing people that you need to move rocks was pretty tough. But I brought my good boulders with me because I had paid money for mine. So I love that story, Daniel. Thanks for sharing.
It's a good one. Thanks, Daniel. Appreciate it very much. Oh, man. You know, as you reflect on this past gardening year, you know, here we are in December, what stood out for you as positives, and maybe what were the biggest negatives in your mind? I'll make you ponder on that for you. Yeah, what do you think?
So positive, I saw new gardeners continuing to garden. You know, I think so many people jumped into gardening with the start of COVID, and a lot of us were worried that, okay, they're going to find out it's some work, and you're not always 100% successful, and they might get discouraged and quit. And I've met many relatively new gardeners who maybe started in 2020 and are excited and learning new things and carrying on. The not-so-positive for me, so in 2020, you know, my calendar, like so many, was full of canceled events.
Yeah.
And so I had a lot of weekends to work in my garden, and then I was doing a lot of media work from my yard, so I added new garden beds. And then 2021 came along, and we found ways to boost the things we were doing, reach more gardeners, and my schedule got really busy, but I bought seeds and plants like it was going to be 2020 again, and the drought and the weeds did really well, and I spent a lot of time this year going, I'm doing the best I can, and like Chris, I have a couple hundred bulbs to get in the ground yet, and I'm like, it's going to thaw. So, and I talked to many a gardener who also struggled with a good crop of weeds and drought, but one of the reasons I love gardening and gardeners is because we're optimistic. You wouldn't do this 2 years in a row if you weren't. So for me, that was the challenge, is now I'm trying to figure out that better balance. So I get in my garden because it brings me so much joy. You know, keep working because I love what I do, just like you do, Larry. And I don't know if we ever find balance in our life, but I'll tell you, getting in the garden sure makes me happy. So I just want to get as much time doing that as possible.
When you think about it, you were doing a lot of planting. Did you find some new plants that you really liked?
You know, I grew garden huckleberries for the first time.
Huh.
I ordered the seeds. I'd tried real huckleberries when I was working in Idaho giving a talk, and I just like, oh, these are great. And they're related to blueberries, but garden huckleberries are related to tomatoes. And so I planted them from seed, got them in the garden, and they were loaded, loaded. And I kept thinking, well, they look ripe, and I take a bite, and I'm like, oh, these are awful. And finally, the killing frost is coming through, so we're going through the garden. I'm pulling up pepper plants that hadn't totally been harvested and the last of the tomatoes, and I thought, well, I'm bringing these garden huckleberries in. Then I did I'd forgotten that they tolerate a light frost, but I made garden huckleberry pie. Oh, it was delicious. And this plant was easy. It was loaded with berries. Next year I'm going to let it get a light frost because that'll concentrate the sugars. That was my new plant to try. My figs, which I grow every year and they die back to the ground, I harvested over 30 figs this year.
Ooh.
The hot weather had some benefits for some plants. And so it was a fun year to try some new things. And I grew more things from seed. Again, I wasn't traveling as much, so I was home to do the watering, and I need to beef up my seed starting operation. I did a lot of non-hardy bulbs, some more elephant ears than normal. I grew a couple of bulbs that I. And my basement's cold, so I put shelving in my bathtub in our spare bathroom and lights. Luckily, we didn't have any company. And eucomies, that was the one. And they bloomed for me. And so it was just so much fun because I went through the catalogs like so many people last winter, and I'm like, oh, I haven't grown that. I'm going to try that. Oh, I haven't grown that. I'm going to try that. So some were success. Some, maybe I need to try again.
Oh, man. It sounds like a great year. Melinda Meyer is our guest today. It's always fun to have her on the show. Certainly, if you have questions for her, I hope you'll join in, or maybe you've got a gardening experience to share from this past year. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest, Melinda Myers, nationally known gardening expert. Her website, melindamyers.com, for you to take a look at. And you can also call us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Let's go to Dennis in Two Rivers next. Dennis, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Sometimes in spring, I've noticed what are kind of like tunnels in my lawn, so I just don't know if that would be from voles. But I've been saving up some grass clippings to insulate the soil around my raspberry plants. But then I've heard, well, voles or something else might girdle or chew away at the bark on plants. So I was wondering, should I insulate the soil around the raspberry plants with the grass clippings, or should I not?
Great question, and you're right. The tunnels are probably from voles, and I'm just going to take a minute because it sounds like you know about voles, but others may not. A lot of people blame moles, but they hibernate for the winter, and they eat insects. Voles, on the other hand, are active year-round, and in the winter, they're running around under the snow, leaving those trails, and I had a lot of them last year in some of the areas in gardens, and so they're looking for seeds. They're eating the bark of smaller plants. So one of several reasons we pull bark away from the trunk of trees and shrubs, the mulch away from the trunk of trees and shrubs or the base of your raspberries, is when it's piled up against there, that does create a nice habitat for the voles. So keeping it a couple inches away, you'll still get the benefits of insulating the soil and the root system, but you help discourage those voles. Typically, what we can do if we're concerned about new plantings, fruit plants, some years I've seen some larger trees damaged when the populations are high, is you can take some hardware cloth, sink it in the ground before the ground freezes, which you know, for some of us, it may be that thaw we get next week. Sink it in 4 to 6 inches, and then at least 4 feet high for rabbits, but to keep the voles out away from the trunk of the tree or those plants that are susceptible. If your raspberries are fall-bearing and you treat them that way, if they munch on them to the ground, that's okay. It saves you pruning. If you grow them as ever-bearing or summer-bearing, where they bloom and produce fruit on the second year canes, yeah, you definitely want to be careful. I don't hear a lot of damage, but again, on raspberries, but again, it depends on the population. And I'm edging into David Drake and Scott Craven's area, but you know, the population I think can be 400 to 1,000 per acre, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
So you know, trying to manage them is challenging. That's where our hawks and some of the natural predators come in. That's why I don't like to use any kind of chemical to kill any unwanted rodents, any rodenticides, because you worry about the good guys that are helping you take care of them. So fencing is one option. Keep that those grass clippings away. Grass clippings aren't really the best insulator. You know, I find shredded bark or wood chips are a little better. It won't hurt anything, and especially around raspberries. And then just keep it away from the base of the plants.
Yeah. And with newly planted, they always kind of, I think I can remember hearing somebody say, wait till the ground freezes before you put the mulch down around it, and the rodents find a different place to hide.
Exactly. Another spot, because you don't want to give them housing and food all at once. So winter mulch, thank you for reminding me, Larry. Winter mulch, we wait till the ground freezes, because the goal there is to keep the ground consistently cold, not to keep it warm. And so, you know, when we have the winter thaw in January or February, you know, that's when the ground starts to shift. If it thaws, it warms up, and then it freezes again. And so that shifting can cause frost heaving. And you may have found plants like coral bells or some of your bulbs or even daylilies pushed out of the ground when that happens. So we do our winter mulch after the ground freezes to keep it consistently cold. So good reminder. Thanks, Larry.
Let's take a call from John, who is heading toward Milwaukee at the moment. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The earlier comments, references to green space, reminded me quickly of a trip I took to Europe a couple of years ago, and I was in a cab in Bucharest, Romania, and I was stunned by the rows of huge mature trees, I mean, probably 50-year-old oaks and that lined the streets. And I thought, I mean, I was just stunned. I've never seen anything like that in any major city. And it was very heartwarming to see that people, you know, cared about the big mature trees. And so that's my comment.
Thank you, John. And you know, one of the things we often over, it's such an important part. You know, when I started my career, and I remember giving a talk, and I was talking about planting oaks, and somebody said, why would I do that? I won't live long enough. And I'm like, well, somebody planted oaks for me to enjoy. And there are some that are fairly fast growing, but keeping those older, large trees, we can't replace them, right? You can't put a new tree that size in its spot. So planting trees sometimes is the easy part. Maintaining them and managing them over decades can be more challenging. So thank you for sharing, because there's nothing more beautiful than a majestic old tree and just the history that goes along with that.
I was thinking about Madison at one point had elms lining every street, and they were like a canopy. It was like you were going through a tunnel at times before the elm bark beetle got here.
Yeah.
And you can still find that in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. That I get up there pretty often, play some golf, and the elm bark beetles, I don't know if they're probably on their way there or maybe getting there now, but it was too cold for them early on, and so they still have some of those elm tree lined streets.
And I think one of the positives, because the pictures you see, and when I worked for forestry, my boss at the time, Dick Meyer, was talking about early in his career, he came in when Dutch elm disease was so, he said, we were just not taking down trees, and it was so depressing. And a lot of urban foresters are looking at, in the city of Milwaukee, too, of diversifying their urban forest. So as much as we love, you know, street after street, something comes in. And so they're looking at diversifying it. So you've got different look, but you also, if something happens, you know, now we're worried about, now we're fighting the emerald ash borer, we don't lose the whole urban forest at one time. So, you know, some good points, and I think there's a lot of work going on, too, related to diversifying that urban forest and our green spaces in general so that we don't set ourselves up for, you know, disaster like the Dutch elm disease and the ash, emerald ash borer that we're experiencing now.
Yeah. John, thanks again. Appreciate it. Christine in Appleton, we'll go to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, hi, thanks for taking my call. I have an asparagus fern that is really old, and it's quite large, and it spends all summer outside on my deck, but of course I bring it in the winter because I'm up in Door County. And I went away for 10 days. Well, I should say, I don't know whether to cut it back or not, so I didn't. And I went away for 10 days. I came back. It looked like Little Shop of Horrors in my house. So they were growing over to the couch, over to the table, up to the lamp, and towards the patio door like they wanted to get out of the house. And I don't know. They're like 3-4 feet long. And I don't know what to do. Then I go to Florida in January, February, March. I come back, and half of the plant is all yellow, and I thought, well, now it's dying. But it all turns green. I put it outside, and it's been 5 months outside again. And that thing is so old. It must be 15 years old.
I have to laugh. I was thinking, I have some asparagus fern, too, and it that goes in and out with pots, and it's in my shop where I keep some plants and store some things and do some work, and they are always grabbing me as I go by. It's not as scary as yours sounds. So more light is going to help encourage more compact growth. You know, continually pruning. Asparagus ferns, you can divide those. So eventually you may want to just lift them out of the pot, maybe late winter, early spring, take a good sharp knife and divide it into smaller pieces if it's getting too hard to move. But it sounds like the size problem is the length of those fronds. So anything to, when we prune plants, we remove growth, but we also stimulate growth. And so doing it a little bit less aggressive. Sometimes you'd have all that stored energy in the root system and no place for it to go, so it pushes out a lot of growth. So, you know, maybe gradually taking back some of those stems back a bit and then making sure it's getting as much light as possible. Though I'll tell you, asparagus ferns, and you found this to be true, really tolerate low light pretty well. Now, it's been outside for the summer, so it's used to really good bright light. You bring it inside, it's less intense. But I would try managing, you know, take a few back, shorten those, and then wait a few more weeks and take it a few more back. And so that you're directing growth, trying to reduce that size, but not all at once, so that stored energy goes into supporting the existing growth rather than producing lots of new long stems.
Christine, thank you so much for calling. It just reminded me, it was talking about reaching. I had the house just before the one I have now was on Lake Monona, and we had an area that looked out on the lake where the ceilings were like 20 feet. So I had a cactus in there. And that cactus, it got almost to 12 feet.
Wow.
It was right at about 12 feet when, and you couldn't have it anywhere else, of course. And I had lopped it off a couple of times because I broke it, you know, but I'd stick, I'd just let it dry out, and then I'd stick it in some soil and it'd start growing again, the other pieces. But that was about 12 feet when I sold the house, and the people asked me, are you going to take the cactus with you? And I said, I don't have a room that's that high enough. And they said, well, can we keep it and do what we want with it?
Yay.
And I say, you are most welcome to keep that cactus.
A bonus with the house. That's great, because that is a challenge, Larry. I get calls occasionally from people who have plants that have outgrown their location, and finding somebody with high ceilings or wide enough space to accommodate. I have somebody's weeping fig. They moved, and friends of mine, and they said, you have a big house with lots of windows. And so I have their weeping fig. But sometimes senior living centers, nursing homes, you may have to, that's where those master gardeners may have a project, a group they're working with that could accommodate, because it is hard to find homes, and you know, we don't want to, I'm sure you were wondering what you were going to do with that plant, and they helped you out, which was great.
I had it for a long time. It was only about 2 feet tall when I got it.
Wow.
So I put a lot of length on that cactus. And
you sure did.
I just
Boy,
go back over
a lot
and
of memories.
Visit. Go back and visit that cactus. Melinda Myers is our guest today. Melinda, nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, author, columnist, over 30 years of horticulture experience. And she has written over 20 gardening books, and she does all kinds of great presentations. And you can find out all about what she's up to and her books and everything else if you go to MelindaMyers.com, MelindaMyers.com. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks for spending some of your day with us. Back with us, Melinda Myers is our guest, nationally known gardening expert, TV radio host, author, columnist. So, what gardening questions are on your mind? How did your garden do this year? Did you have a good year in the garden? And I want to put a little holiday spin on it, too, since we're right in that season. What would you like for a gardening gift for holidays, or what are you planning to give for one? I'm going to ask Melinda that question, too, to see if she has some ideas for good gardening gifts. All that and, of course, your gardening questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Melinda, we got an email from Bill in Oregon, and he emailed that before committing plants to a roadside area, he suggests you dig a hole in your intended planting area to about 18 inches deep, if you can. This should give you a good idea of your soil depth and possibly what is beneath it. A common issue for roadside areas is that you only have maybe 6 to 12 inches of soil above road fill or gravel. And, of course, this requires drought-tolerant plants. And he's had good success with a variety of prairie flowers, and I have as well with prairie plants. But what do you think?
That's, you know, anything we can do to evaluate our soil before we plant and fix it if need be, you know, adding compost, organic matter. Some of the research out of Cornell has found that not only are you improving drainage and heavier soils, which is often the case between the sidewalk and curb in much of the state, it also increases the water holding ability for those of us with gravel sand conditions. But it also improves plant growth and reduces problems with insects and disease. Some of the problems, too, is, you know, native plants are always a good choice, and just trying to see what works for you. If you could put any kind of screening, you know, again, depending on what your municipality requires to keep the salt spray from passing vehicles is helpful as well. And then a good soaking in the spring to wash any salts off the plants and through the soil. So if you've done what Bill suggests and you fix your soil and you do that, try to leach those salts through, you're going to have much better success. You know, typically our springs used to be very wet. That isn't always the case. And so if we don't get those good spring rains, a good thorough watering will definitely help. But anything we can do to improve the soil anywhere we garden is going to help, especially in those tougher, sometimes called the hell strips, where they tend to be very hot, dry, and poor soil conditions because you've had the work on the curb, you've had the work on the sidewalk, so you often have a lot of debris and then subsoil, and as Bill was saying, not the best growing conditions.
And I might just add, as you were talking, I was thinking about my own case. Before I did the digging, I called Digger's Hotline.
Oh,
which,
thank you.
And I was a little surprised at what I found in a couple of areas on the property, so that there were some things there that I didn't know about.
You know, and shame on me because I work with Digger's Hotline, so please forgive me, folks. But, yes, always make that call at least 3 business days. 811 is the national number, or file online at diggershotline.com. And they'll send the utility companies out to mark what's underground. And as you said, sometimes you're surprised. And it can prevent damage. It can prevent injury to you, even death. And it also can save you money because if you hit an underground utility and you didn't have it marked, yes, you're responsible. And in my book, and I think for you too, Larry, we'd much rather buy plants
yes.
than spend it on fixing fiber optic cable. So, you know, it's free. Call in advance. Find out what's there. Even in the planning stages, it's a good idea because you may be able to move a garden bed a little to one side or the other, or plan your design with the underground utilities in mind. So thank you for mentioning that.
Let's take a call from Karen in Madison. Karen, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm calling about street trees.
Okay.
It's always an emotional subject for people who like trees. And I'm wondering, when are we going to move as a culture and as cities to protect street trees and give them priority over development and asphalt and concrete, give them space more than however little bitty terraces have water. This last spring, these last 2 years have been very dry, and our street trees that we put in, and our street would have been concrete and asphalt. We didn't, anyway, it's an unusual street, and the trees are really suffering because of the lack of water and space. And, you know, and they recently put a development in our area, which we begged that they had about 20 mature trees. One was a ginkgo tree that was about 30 feet tall. They lived to be 1,000 years old, in the thousands. And we begged that they could incorporate into their plans this bit of green, and it had been a park at one time in the city of Madison, to no avail, and all the trees were bulldozed and taken down. And I've seen a reduction in birds in our neighborhood. Actually, it's probably as a result of the drought, because I have also seen a reduction of insects. And if you drive in the country in the summer now, you don't get a windshield full of insects.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah, it's. Go ahead, Melinda.
I was going to say, Pennsylvania put on a series on stormwater management. Is I think one of the things I've learned is that we have to find out what's going to appeal to different people. What motivates me to keep trees alive, and you, Karen, may not motivate someone else. And one of the things I'm seeing is we're all being overwhelmed with stormwater, and Fresh Coast Guardians is really giving us great ideas of how to keep water on our property. And planting trees is a great way to manage stormwater. Pennsylvania State University put a series of webinars out last year, and they might still be available, on stormwater management and plantings. And a lot of the research and they're doing research, which then hopefully will motivate people, because then you have the science behind you, Karen, and hopefully people will listen to how we can put plantings and trees along our streets to help manage flooding, reduce water in basements. You know, you're talking about the drought. Exactly. That's hard on the trees, and then they're not there for when we have all the excess rain to absorb that. You know, the trees, When the rain hits the tree, they capture some in the canopy and it's evaporated back. Some of it travels along the branches and trunk much slower rate when it hits the soil. Preventing erosion allows that to be absorbed. What the tree absorbs, it uses, and the excess then is evaporated back in the atmosphere. So trees really have a big impact on water. And as you mentioned, insects, pollinators, birds, as well as our environment, shading our homes, reducing wind so we don't spend as much money on heating and cooling. And I think, you know, there's so many issues we all are trying to address, whatever our priorities are, but I think sharing this information with the powers to be and your neighbors, and it sounds like you're already doing a good job trying to save the trees in your community. And so I think if we look positively, there's research happening and trying to take that forward to make that difference that you're talking about.
Yeah. Karen, thank you so much. Appreciate it. And again, you can join us 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Ideas@wpr.org. I mentioned just at the top of the hour that I was going to ask you about your ideas for Christmas or holiday gifts for the gardener. Are there some that you would suggest?
You know, one of my favorite things, if you've not grown amaryllis, it's Longfield Gardens is one of my clients, and they sell beautiful amaryllis. And so I'm always a sucker. I write an article, and then I buy what I write about. So not sure it's the most profitable arrangement. But I bought a bunch of amaryllis, and I potted them up, and I've given them to some friends that are gardeners. Some had never planted amaryllis, and I printed out a picture of what the pictures, you know, of what the plant's going to look like when it blooms. And we talked about, in fact, I was at a restaurant with some friends last night, and we had the amaryllis as a centerpiece. And the person from the place comes out, he goes, "I have an amaryllis," and he brought it from his office to show me. So great conversation. But, you know, it's one of those plants that watching when it starts to grow and you watch the flower stalk and then you watch it unfurl and you get a good, nice bulb. I've got some double ones just starting to bloom, and, you know, it's going to have three flower stalks on these big bulbs. And so it's exciting because it's something you can watch change over time. And so I think that's a gift that keeps giving. And we're seeing more and more potted forced bulbs available. Like Gardener Supply has 6 months of bloom. That's what I got for my in-laws, so that they'll get a pot in December, January, February, and every month it'll be different bulbs and they can watch them sprout and grow. So, you know, kind of bringing a bit of spring inside. On a smaller budget, I love to do projects with my grandkids, and we took clay pots and acrylic paint and big bottles, turn the pot upside down, put tape over the hole on the bottom, and then they just squirted the paint. It was fun for all of us. And then we let that dry, and then they, for teachers or friends, they could put maybe some seeds or maybe some little small houseplant garden tools or even plant a plant in there and give it as a gift. So that's a fun thing to do. A windowsill herb garden. You know, I think we're all facing winter, and it can be long. And so having some fresh herbs right from your windowsill, maybe giving them the start of that windowsill garden, you know, some seeds, or if you can find the plants and a nice planter, something decorative that they could put on their windowsill or just set back from the window where it's a little bit warmer, might be a fun thing. And then a gift certificate. And one reason I like gift certificates, I don't know about you, but when somebody gives me a gift certificate either to my favorite catalog or my favorite garden center, one of the fun things is I spend a lot more time thinking about how I'm going to spend that money, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those gifts that you spend hours looking at the catalog. Ooh, I got this much money I wasn't counting on. What do I want to buy that I wouldn't normally get for myself? And tools. You know, I work with Corona Tools, so I just want to disclose that. But they have a flex dial bypass pruner, and you set the opening of the handle. So what's nice, if people share the tool, and when somebody has a big hand and somebody has a smaller hand, you just adjust it. Or if you give it as a gift, finding that pruner that fits the right size of their hand can be challenging. This one, they can adjust it. And if the opening's the right size, you're not going to spend a lot of energy trying to close that, and so you can work longer with less fatigue. So those are just a few of my
great ideas
and fun things to receive, in case anybody's wondering out there.
Well, let's take another call from Shar in New Berlin. Shar, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry and Melinda.
Hi.
We have a mutual friend, Melinda Doris, who had who had this most beautiful huge pink bush. It looked like a bush from the distance, and it was about 3 feet wide and 3 feet tall. Well, when we walked over there and looked and talked to her, it wasn't a bush. It was a Japanese anemone that I thought was just beautiful. And so I was able, not from her, but somewhere, I got some seeds from an anemone, Japanese, which I know are supposed to be invasive, but anyway, I like them anyway. And I don't know if they need to be winter cold to sprout or how I would plant these seeds.
Good question. If they're the grape leaf Japanese Robitussifolium, they can be aggressive. I haven't seen that the true Japanese anemone is invasive. And I only want to differentiate because we don't want to plant invasive plants. Aggressive plants we just need to contain. And what I always like to do when I'm not sure about a plant is I look at where it grows. And so if that plant grows and drops its seeds in the fall, it probably would benefit from a winter chill, just like it would get out in nature. You know, if it's native to a much milder climate and or drops its seeds earlier in the season and you get little seedlings before winter, then it probably doesn't. So what I would do is pack those seeds in, you know, put them in a, let them make sure they're dry, put them in an envelope, label them, put them in your refrigerator. They don't need to be frozen. And that should be that should help you have success with those. And then you could start them inside for an earlier bloom outside.
Sounds like a plan. Thank you, Shar, for calling. Appreciate it. Tom in Thiensville, it's your turn.
Thank you. I turned on my car, and your show came on just in time for me to hear Melinda talk about garden huckleberries and a fig. Now, I have tried the potted varieties of dwarf tropical stuff, you know, Meyer lemons, and I had a kumquat that did fantastic, but it never produced any kumquats. So it sounded to me like you were growing this fig outdoors, and I would like to know about that. Where do you find them, and what variety fig and huckleberries can you get?
So the garden huckleberry is an annual, so it's not the blueberry relative. It looks like a blueberry. It has a little more tang than a regular blueberry, and I bought my seeds, I ordered seeds from a bunch of different places, and I can't remember where, but I'm sure if you go online, you could find seeds. You'll probably have to order them, and it's garden huckleberry, and they were really easy to start, just like you would a tomato or a pepper, because they're related to those, and so it's an annual, so I'll have to start over again next year, but I'll tell you, I made one pie, I froze a second, and I have enough to make a third pie from one plant. So, hey, I was happy.
That's pretty good.
It is. And then for figs, I grow mine outside in Chicago Hardy and Brown Turkey. And so they die back to the ground. And I have to say, if we have a cool summer, I usually get a half a dozen figs. But because it was so hot this year, it was very productive. I've never had winter protection. When I gardened in the city, I had much better productivity because it was milder, a very sheltered spot. My garage was a brick, and my neighbor's house was brick, and my house was brick. So it was a really nice microclimate. So it was nice and warm there. I did just order some cover because last year I had about 20 figs that were almost ready to pick, and then we had our, of course, killing frost. So I'm going to add some a high tunnel, so to speak, just a very tall 8 foot high cover, and with a row cover that lets air, light, and water through, so that I could jump start them in the spring and extend the season in the fall. which I've never done, and I still get figs. So even if you do nothing, you'll get something. But now I'm motivated. I want more figs. After this year's big harvest, I want this trend to continue. So check out Brown Turkey and also Chicago Hardy. They die back to the ground. We only get one crop. I bought mine at Ebert's Greenhouse Village in Exonia, just west of Oconomowoc, and you can also order them online as well.
Our executive producer, Molly Stentz, has a Chicago Hardy fig, and
she
brings it in and has good luck with it. So,
and you know,
go.
That's the other option, too, is to bring it in. And I find it doesn't have – I have one in a pot, too, and I find it doesn't have the insect problems that my citrus have. I know you are – your limey has been with you for years. And every once in a while, I have to thin my citrus where the scale just gets so bad. And I do the Summit Your Own spray oil, and I can manage it, get it outside for the birds to clean up. But, you know, they are very susceptible to scale. But the figs tend to have very few insect problems. At least that's what I found. It sounds like your producers had really good luck, too.
Mm-hmm. Tom? Excuse me, Tom. Thanks again. Deborah, do you have a quick question?
Well, I'll just say my husband gave me a worm composting setup last Christmas, and this year a bunch of my friends are going to get worm poop for Christmas.
You know what? That is a great gift.
I'll apologize now to anyone listening. Yes.
Surprise. Act surprise.
Oh, man. And you wonder about fruit trees for wet areas.
Yeah. We've got an acre of land all open. Used to be a garden, but the creek overruns now and then. It's a little spongy, and we'd like to grow fruit, not something like that.
Okay.
Elderberries are excellent. They're not the easiest to manage because they're tiny little berries, and, you know, making jams and jellies and wine, of course, are just to feed the birds. That might be one to serve. Aronias, which are very high in antioxidants, and picking at the right time and then managing those will take wet conditions too, and they're beautiful flowers, nice leaves, great fall color. The fruit persists because the birds don't even like it. It's so astringent, but harvest it and you can make some good jams and jellies and pies. And I met a grower who said it's just finding the right time for the sugar, which I never do on my aronias. But those would be my two first choices. Service berries will take it moist, maybe not flooded, so maybe back a little further where, you know, it's not going to stay wet for, you know, more than
forever.
A few days.
Yeah,
you might have some luck. So those would be my top choices.
Well, Melinda, it is always a great pleasure to have you come by, and especially during this holiday season. I want to wish you the very best holidays and a wonderful new year, and I'm hoping you'll come back and be with us in 2022.
Oh, I'd love to, Larry, and the same to you and your team and family and all the gardeners out there. You guys, you know what, got me through COVID, staying in touch and, you know, keeping us talking about planting bulbs in December and, you know, doing crazy things. So, Larry, thanks so much for having me on.
Melinda Myers, take a look at her website. It's melindamyers.com, melindamyers.com. Oh, it's always fun talking with her. She does such a great job, doesn't she? Thinking ahead to Monday, Beth D'Angelo is back to talk, this time about smartwatches, what they can do and how people are using them. That's Monday on the Ideas Network. But in the meantime, boy, I hope you stay with us. There's lots of good, interesting things going on right through the afternoon here on the Ideas Network. And you should listen in and take advantage of them. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk.